Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to break down complex ideas into the knowledge you can really use. And today we're digging into something fundamental based on a lecture by Dr. Hoffman.
Yeah, it's all about how ecosystems handle energy and materials.
Yeah.
You know, the absolute basic rules.
Exactly. And Dr. Hoffman kicks it off with a kind of puzzle, doesn't he? About rust.
He does. It's great. How can you possibly get rust iron oxide miles down in the ocean where there's basically no light and hardly any oxygen? Seems wrong.
Right. It totally hooks you. And solving that sets our mission for this deep dive. But first, we need that core concept Dr. Hoffman hammers home.
The big one. Energy flows through an ecosystem. It comes in, usually as light, does its work, and then leaves as heat. Can't get it back easily.
But the materials, the atoms, the chemicals.
Those get recycled. They stay within the system, cycling around. Flow versus cycle. That's the key distinction we need to keep in mind.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Part one. Producers and respiration. Every ecosystem needs someone or something making the initial fuel.
Yep, the producers. And mostly that means phototrophs, plants, algae, things using sunlight, photosynthesis.
But Dr. Hoffman points out the exceptions, like that deep sea environment, no sunlight there.
Right, so you get chemosynthesis. Mm. These producers use chemical energy, maybe from volcanic vents or other weird sources, instead of light.
But either way, light or chemical, they have to do this thing called carbon fixation. What exactly is that, in simple terms?
It's basically grabbing inorganic carbon, like CO2 from the air or water, and locking it into an organic molecule, like sugar, building the first bit of food.
And producers do that. We consumers, we just eat it.
We eat it or eat something else that ate it.
Yeah.
And we get the energy back out through cellular respiration.
Which is essentially taking apart those organic molecules, those carbon skeletons Dr. Hoffman talks about.
Exactly. Breaking the bonds releases energy. And the leftover carbon after you strip the energy off, that becomes CO2. That's what we exhale.
Now, Dr. Hoffman touches on the electron transport chain, which sounds complicated. But what's the key takeaway for understanding energy release?
You don't need all the biochemistry details. Think of it like a tiny assembly line, or maybe disassembly line, pulling energy off step by step. It involves moving tiny particles, electrons and protons, from hydrogen.
Okay.
But for that line to keep moving smoothly, you need something at the very end to take away the used up bits, the electrons, like a disposal bin.
And that disposal bin is oxygen.
For us and most animals, yes. That's pretty much the main reason we need to breathe oxygen. It's the final electron acceptor. It grabs those electrons, combines with hydrogen, makes water, and boom, the chain keeps running, making lots of energy.
Without oxygen.
Chain gets clogged, backs up, energy production plummets.
Ah, okay, so back to the deep sea. Low oxygen. What are those organisms using instead of oxygen at the end of their chain?
They switch tactics. They use anaerobic respiration. It's less efficient, but it works. And instead of oxygen, some deep sea bacteria, as Dr. Hoffman explains, use other things, like iron ions.
Iron ions act as the electron acceptor.
Exactly. So the bacteria breathe iron, in a way. And when the iron accepts those electrons, it gets chemically reduced.
Okay, so now you have this reduced iron floating around down there.
Right. And maybe currents stir it up, bring it closer to the surface where there's more oxygen.
And when that reduced iron meets oxygen?
Wham! It oxidizes. Rapidly, forming iron oxide.
Rust.
Rust. That's the rust Dr. Hoffman was talking about. It's a direct chemical sign of life breathing something other than oxygen in the deep dark. Pretty amazing.
That really clarifies it. Okay, so every organism is burning fuel just to live. Respiration. That means they're constantly unfixing the carbon producers worked so hard to fix.
Right, it's this constant back and forth. Photosynthesis builds, respiration breaks down. So we need ways to measure if the ecosystem is actually gaining ground, you know, building up more than it's breaking down.
Dr. Hoffman gives us three metrics for this. Let's try that financial analogy he hinted at. First, GPP.
Gross primary production. That's the total amount of energy captured by producers from sunlight or chemicals over a certain time. Think of it like the total revenue of a company, all the money coming in.
Okay, total income. But the producers themselves need energy to live, right? They respire too.
Absolutely, that's their operating cost. So you take the GBP, subtract the energy the producers use for their own respiration, that's our sub A autotroph respiration, and what's left is NPP.
Net primary production. So that's the energy actually stored as new growth, the stuff available for herbivores to eat, like the company's profit after paying its own bills.
Sort of, yeah. Or maybe like the money left over to reinvest or distribute. It's the net gain for the producer level.
Got it. And the last one, NEP.
Net ecosystem production. This is GPP minus the respiration of everyone in the ecosystem, producers, consumers, decomposers, the whole lot, R sub T, total respiration.
So NEP tells you if the entire ecosystem, the whole community, is accumulating biomass or losing it over time. Is the whole forest growing or shrinking?
Precisely. If NEP is positive, the ecosystem's carbon bank account is growing.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, underpinning all this energy transfer is physics, the second law of thermodynamics.
Ah, yes, the universe's tax collector. Dr. Hoffman's caterpillar example is perfect here.
Right. The caterpillar eats, say, 200 joules of leaf, but a lot of that doesn't even get absorbed.
Yeah, like half might just pass through as feces, undigested. So maybe 100 joules are assimilated.
And even of that 100 joules absorbed, it uses a huge chunk just staying alive, respiration again.
Easily two-thirds, maybe 65, 70 joules, just burned for basic metabolism, movement, keeping warm. Only the small remainder, maybe 30, 35 joules, actually goes into making more caterpillar growth or reproduction.
It's incredibly inefficient.
That's the second law. Energy transformations are messy. You always lose some usable energy as heat. It doesn't vanish, but it becomes low-grade, disorganized heat you can't really use to do work every single step.
And this leads to the famous 10% rule in ecology.
Roughly, yeah. Only about 10% of the energy from one trophic level, say plants, actually gets incorporated into the biomass of the next level, herbivores.
Mm.
The other 90% is lost along the way. Respiration, waste, heat.
Which is why food chains can't be infinitely long. You just run out of energy.
Exactly. By the time you get to tertiary consumers, eating the carnivores that ate the herbivores, you're down to a tiny fraction of the original producer energy.
And because energy is always lost, the energy pyramid has to be pyramid-shaped, right? Wider at the bottom, narrow at the top.
Always. For energy, it must be upright, no exceptions. But Dr. Hoffman pointed out an interesting case with biomass pyramids.
Ah, right. Sometimes they can look inverted, flipped.
Yeah, especially in some aquatic systems. Think of tiny phytoplankton, the producers, being eaten by a slightly larger zooplankton, the consumers.
How can the consumer biomass be greater than the producer biomass at one point in time?
It's about turnover rate. The phytoplankton are incredibly productive, reproducing super fast, but they get eaten almost immediately by the zooplankton. So at any given snapshot in time, the standing biomass of phytoplankton might be small, but they're generating energy like crazy. Mm. The zooplankton live longer and accumulate.
So the total energy processed over time still follows the pyramid shape, even if the snapshot of mass looks weird.
Exactly. The physics of energy flow isn't violated. It's just a timing effect.
Okay, shifting gears a bit. Let's go back from energy flow to material recycling. What limits growth?
Dr. Hoffman used that great chemistry analogy, the limiting reagent. If you're baking cakes and need flour and sugar and you run out of sugar...
Doesn't matter how much flour you have, you can't make more cakes.
Bingo. Same in ecosystems. Something runs out first and stops growth. On land, often it's water. Or maybe light in a dense forest understory.
But in the ocean, Dr. Hoffman said light often isn't the main problem, especially near the surface.
Right. More often it's nutrients, specifically nitrogen, often as ammonium or phosphorus, as phosphate. These essential building blocks run short.
And it's not always the same thing everywhere.
Definitely not. That Sargasso C experiment he mentioned is key. They added nitrogen. Nothing. Added phosphorus. Nothing much. Added both. Still not much.
But when they added iron.
Boom. Production shot up. In that specific part of the ocean, iron was the limiting nutrient, the thing they ran out of first. It shows how context-dependent it is.
And getting those nutrients back into circulation depends on decomposition, right? Breaking down dead
stuff. Absolutely vital. Decomposition recycles the materials, turns dead organic matter back into inorganic nutrients producers can use again. Closing the loop.
And the speed of that depends hugely on the environment.
Oh, massively. Think warm, wet, tropical rainforest versus a cold, dry tundra or northern forest. Decomposition is way faster in the tropics. That's why you don't see huge piles of dead leaves on the rainforest floor. It gets broken down quickly.
Whereas in colder forests, decomposition is slow, so you get that thick layer of leaf litter building up, nutrients locked away.
Exactly. Temperature, moisture, oxygen levels, they all control decomposition rates.
Okay, so this leads us to the big biogeochemical cycles Dr. Hoffman covered, the grand recycling programs of the planet. He focused on four main ones.
Yeah, the indispensable ones.
Yeah.
First, water cycle. Pretty straightforward. Evaporation, condensation, precipitation. It's global because water vapor travels everywhere.
And indispensable because?
Life is water chemistry. Everything happens in aqueous solution inside cells. Can't live without it.
Makes sense. Next, carbon cycle. Also global, because CO2 gas mixes through the atmosphere.
And carbon is the backbone. Proteins, fats, carbs, DNA, RNA, everything organic is built on carbon skeletons. Absolutely essential.
This is where Dr. Hoffman issued that warning, wasn't it, about the current state of the cycle?
Yes. He stressed that historically, the amount of CO2 taken out by photosynthesis roughly balanced the amount put back by respiration. But burning fossil fuels is different.
How so?
We're releasing vast amounts of carbon that was locked away underground for millions of years. Carbon from the past, as he put it. It's like opening a geological vault.
And the natural system, photosynthesis mainly, just can't absorb it fast enough?
That's the problem. We're pumping CO2 into the atmosphere faster than the cycle can actually remove it, leading to that buildup and its consequences like climate change.
Okay. Third cycle, nitrogen. Also global, since N2 gas is most of our air. Why is nitrogen critical?
Two huge reasons. All proteins contain nitrogen in their amino acids, and all nucleic acids, DNA, RNA, contain nitrogen in their bases. No nitrogen, no proteins, no genes. Simple as that.
Wow. Okay. And the final one, phosphorus cycle. This one's different, he said, more local.
Yeah, because phosphorus compounds don't really have a common gaseous form to spread globally through the air. It tends to cycle more locally, through rocks, soil, water, and organisms.
But still indispensable.
Oh, absolutely. Phosphorus is crucial for nucleic acids. Again, it forms the phosphate backbone of DNA and RNA. Plus, it's the P in ATP adenosine triphosphate.
The energy currency molecule.
The very same.
Yeah.
And Dr. Hoffman also highlighted phosphorylation, adding or removing phosphate groups, is like a biological switch, turning proteins and enzymes on or off. Hugely important for regulating cellular activity.
So water, carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, the big four material cycles. And humans are impacting these.
Definitely. We saw the carbon impact, but Dr. Hoffman also used that Hubbard Brook experiment to show another impact.
Right, where they cut down a whole forest.
Yes, on a watershed where the underlying bedrock prevented water from seeping out underneath. They deforested it and then measured the water running off the valley.
And what happened?
A huge spike in nutrient loss, especially nitrogen, in the stream water. Removing the trees, the producers, removed the system's ability to hold on to those vital nutrients. They just washed away.
It really shows how important the living parts are for maintaining the whole system's balance, holding on to materials.
Exactly. Producers aren't just making food. They're stabilizing the entire nutrient economy.
So when we damage ecosystems, how do we try to fix them? Dr. Hoffman talked about two approaches, restoration and remediation.
Yeah, distinct ideas. Restoration is basically trying to put back what was there naturally, replanting a log forest, restoring a drained wetland, maybe fixing the physical landscape of an old mine.
Okay, putting back the good stuff. What's remediation?
Remediation is about cleaning up messes we've made, taking out the bad stuff we put in. Toxic waste, chemical spills, heavy metals, radioactive contamination.
And for that, for remediation, Dr. Hoffman emphasized something maybe unexpected.
Microorganisms,
yeah.
Bacteria, mostly. The incredible diversity of microbial biochemistry is our best tool. It's called bioremediation.
How does that work?
Because there are bacteria that have evolved or can evolve to metabolize almost anything, including many pollutants humans created. They can essentially eat the pollution, breaking down complex toxic organic compounds into simpler, harmless ones.
Using the pollution as their food source.
Pretty much. And it can be incredibly effective. He showed that data where introducing the right bacteria dropped uranium concentration in contaminated groundwater by like 60% in just a few weeks.
That's remarkable, using life to clean up the damage done to life support systems.
It really is. It shows the power inherent in these natural chemical processes governed by the laws we've been talking about.
So we've gone from puzzling out rust in the deep ocean to the strict rules of energy transfer, the 10% inefficiency, the vital cycling of materials.
Yeah, and all the way to harnessing microbes to clean up uranium. It all connects.
What Dr. Hoffman really ties together is how everything from the tiniest bacterium to the global climate operates under these fundamental rules of chemistry and physics, energy flows, material cycle.
And it's all about balance, isn't it? That reciprocal equation, photosynthesis building things up, respiration breaking them down. The natural world is constantly seeking equilibrium.
But human activity, especially releasing all that stored energy and carbon, is pushing that equilibrium way off balance.
On a scale and speed the planet hasn't seen in a very, very long time. It's the core message, really. Understanding the rules shows us the impact of breaking them.
Which brings us to a final thought for you, listening. Life's core processes, making, using, decomposing, are this elegant reciprocal equation, constantly balancing. So maybe think about this. What chemical or energetic equations are you balancing in your own life, maybe without even thinking about it? And more critically, are there larger equations, resource use, waste, where your actions might be contributing even slightly to throwing things out of equilibrium?
Something to definitely mull over. It connects the personal to the planetary.
Indeed. Join us next time for another deep dive.